uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my goodness. Karl Rove, he's in charge of everything, it seems. He's in charge of the reconstruction effort in the Gulf Coast, in Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi. He's in charge of George W. Bush. Bush's brain. He's in charge of outing CIA agents. He's in charge of, now we discover, immigration policy. Truly, truly bizarre stuff. By the way, in the second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking with Judith Baca about how does art promote social change? Art? And, you know, it's actually a very, there's some very tough questions in that. You know, what role should society play in promoting art? Should they take our tax dollars at the barrel of a gun to promote art or not? You know, to paraphrase the conservative rant against the National Institute, against the various, actually various different kinds of programs. And in the third hour of our program, we're going to be talking with a conservative, president of the Public Service Research Foundation. He's going to be saying that it's just a fine thing. In fact, it's the right thing that George W. Bush suspended the Davis-Bacon Act for the survivors of Hurricane Katrina so that they can be paid $5.15 an hour instead of $9 an hour to participate in cleaning up their own city. We're going to get into John Roberts as his confirmation of smokescreen, and what does that have to do with mimes? Is the middle class collapsing around us? Lots that we're going to get into today. But first, Karl Rove, this, a fax shows up in the office by accident, by mistake. A fax shows up in the office of a Democratic congressman who shared it with the press anonymously. It's addressed to the Honorable Karl Rove, which is pretty strange to begin with. First of all, this guy is not honorable. He's dishonorable. He's a traitor. He commits treason against the United States of America, outs a CIA agent, brings down an entire CIA operation. You got this whole thing, Brewster Jennings, this front corporation that's operating offices all around the world where they're saying to terrorists, hey, you want to buy some shoulder-fired Stinger missiles? No problem. We'll get them to you. Just come on by and have a conversation with us. Run by the CIA, one of our major counterterrorism intelligence gathering operations. And the CEO of Brewster Jennings, a woman in Washington, D.C., by the name of Valerie Plame. And suddenly her name appears in the press, and guess what happens to Brewster Jennings? Of course, it's toast. Guess what happens to all of those CIA assets all over the world? The CIA agents, the spies, the people, the locals around the world who were running the local front companies trying to sell things to the local terrorists. We still don't know how many of them have turned up dead. The Bush administration won't tell us. I think we can safely say if the number was zero, they would have told us. We don't know how many have died. We do know that our intelligence has been seriously compromised because this senior administration official, Karl Rove, decided to commit treason.
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official.
Hoping here.
This is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah. So anyhow, that the Honorable Karl Rove, this memo says, honorable is a title for people who are elected to the House of Representatives, typically. You know, the Honorable Congressman or the Honorable Bernie Sanders. It would be how you would address Bernie Sanders. The Honorable Bernie Sanders. But Karl Rove's never been elected to anything except for, you know, the Young Republicans back when he was sabotaging elections for the Republicans in college. So here comes this email, or this fax, rather, from the office of the Honorable Lamar Smith, the congressman from the 21st District of Texas, the Republican, to the Honorable Karl Rove, dated 9/14/05, immigration meeting. Because of a steering committee meeting this afternoon to pick the next chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, I cannot attend today's discussion on immigration. I hope there will be another time soon we can get together to talk about this issue and several others. Oh, I thought that Karl Rove was leading the command, you know, heading up the effort to solve the Katrina problem. But apparently there's other fish to fry, other more important things. Anyhow, the memo continues from Lamar Smith. Immigration needs to be considered in the context of, one, media bias. What? Two, animosity toward the president. And three, revealings of the Republican base. Now, have you noticed? And then he says all three should be considered when deciding how to proceed on immigration legislation. This is a member of the United States Congress. Lamar Smith, representative from Texas. Have you noticed something missing from that list? Let me just share it with you one more time. It might, you know, might not be absolutely conspicuous. Maybe it went by fast enough that you didn't catch it. Lamar Smith, his email to, or his fax to Karl Rove. He goes on, by the way, to say, you read polls better than anyone. So you know that the majority of American people, including Democrats and Hispanics, feel illegal immigration is a serious problem. So he says, immigration needs to be considered in the context of, one, media bias, two, animosity toward the president, and three, the feelings of the Republican base. All three should be considered when deciding how to proceed on immigration legislation. He adds, liberals can easily and accurately be painted as opposing enforcement. What? See, this is, you know, they make up straw men and then attack them. But what's missing from the list? What's missing from the list is what's in the best interest of the United States of America. I mean, this guy's a congressman. He's a member of Congress. What's his job? His job is to represent his district and to serve the Constitution. He took an oath of loyalty to serve and protect the Constitution of the United States. And is that even... It's not even number four on the list. It's not number seven on the list. It's not even mentioned anywhere. Here you have a member of the United States Congress whose job is to respect and to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States and this nation. And he said, and immigration is certainly a threat to the integrity of this nation. Illegal immigration, excuse me. Immigration, fine thing. I'm all in favor of it. Illegal immigration, certainly a threat to this country. Both economically, politically, socially. That's the reason why we have immigration laws. It's very simple, as does every other nation on earth. So what does he say we should do? He says enforcement of immigration laws, current and new, should come first to satisfy the increasing demand for border security. Yeah. He says only then, as enforcement begins to gain traction, should the twin subjects of guest workers and longtime illegal residents be addressed. Either involves a huge new bureaucracy that would have to process perhaps millions of applications, enforce hundreds of new regulations, monitor thousands of employers. Extensive hearings should be held to evaluate the impact of any new immigration programs on America's workers, the economy, and taxpayers. Well, that's nice. But his first three considerations, media bias, animosity toward the president, feelings of the Republican base. Here's the deal with immigration. This is very simple. You've got roughly 10% of the population of Mexico living in the United States, working illegally, producing about 10% of the gross domestic product of Mexico in terms of money that's sent back to Mexico. Obviously, it's not just Mexicans, but that's the largest proportion of them. And the conservative answer is make our borders bigger. Let's build a wall. Let's do like Israel's doing. Let's build a wall between us and Mexico. Well, you know, that is the most absurd thing because 40 years ago, there was no problem with illegal immigration, or at the worst, a very small problem. What's the difference between 40 years ago and now? The difference between 40 years ago and now is that 40 years ago, we had strong organized labor, a strong middle class, and an average wage in the United States where an average person could support a family. You had 35% of Americans in unions in the 1970s, which meant 70% of all Americans had a job where they could put their family through, they could put their kids through school, had all their health care expenses covered, they had a pension, they could retire, they could live a middle-class lifestyle. Now, as a result of conservative economic policies, it's down to 8% of the workforce is unionized, the private workforce, and that was our first line of defense against illegal immigrants coming into the workforce. You pass a law that says that the CEO of any corporation that hires an illegal immigrant goes to jail for a year. And the next week, you're going to have somewhere between 3 and 10 million illegal immigrants trying to get out of this country as fast as they can because nobody will hire them. You don't need a wall. All you need is rational policies. But no, then Walmart couldn't make quite so much money. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming.
Yeah, because the times, you know,
I'll be later to win, for the times, they are changing.
Well said, Bob. And once again, the times are changing. I'm telling you, the American people are waking up. They are waking up. They are seeing, for example, with regard to immigration, they're seeing that there's a reason why George W. Bush wants to restart the Bracero program, where basically guest workers, illegal immigrants, will be allowed to stay in the country as long as they have a card certifying that they have an employer. Now, what does that do? It establishes a disproportionate amount of power in the hands of the employer, so they can abuse the employees any way they want. They can treat them as badly as they want, and those people know that if they lose their job, they get deported. So how many people do you think are going to speak up against unsafe working conditions? How many people are going to speak up against abuse in the workplace? How many people are going to speak up in favor of rational working hours? How many people are going to speak up in favor of decent pay? How many people are going to say, gee, I'd like to have some health insurance? How many people are even going to be willing to take time off when they're sick or when they have children? Very few. Nice, compliant workforce. It's this Dickensian world, the world that Charles Dickens described in his novel A Christmas Carol, and so many of his other novels as well. Most people are familiar at least with A Christmas Carol, where you have the very wealthy ruling class, and you have then a whole lot of very terrified workers. The conservative vision for America. And they're unabashed about it. I mean, it's not like they're ashamed of it. They're proud of it. Look at this, George W. Bush. He says, oh, there's a disaster. Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, a disaster down there. We're going to allocate $200 billion. Now, let's say a million people have been affected by this thing, you know, in three states, lost their homes. I mean, there's a half a million people in New Orleans. Let's say a million people. You divide a million into $200 billion, and if I'm doing my math right, let's see, $200 billion, one-tenth of that is $20 billion, one-one-hundredth of that is $2 billion. 1/1,000th of that. Well, anyhow, it seems to me, I'm sure somebody in the chat room will correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I haven't done it on a calculator. I probably should. It's too many years since I learned simple math, right? But I think that if you divide $200 billion by a million, you come up with $200,000 a person. I could be wrong, but I think that that's the number. And George W. Bush said, well, obviously, a lot of that is going to go for infrastructure, rebuilding roads, bridges, septic systems, water systems. I mean, there's a lot that has to be spent there. But nonetheless, there, you know, he's talking about a fair investment. And so what do we have to do? Well, we got to bring in the big contractors, Halliburton, Bechtel, and let's suspend the Davis-Bacon Act so that the prevailing wage of $9 an hour, what people were making before the disaster, they no longer have to earn that. We can pay them $5 an hour. $5.15, the federal minimum wage. the conservative agenda writ large. The same thing with immigration. The simple reason why George W. Bush has done absolutely nothing to stem the tide of illegal immigration other than a few cosmetic appearances down at the border. Not him down at the border, but, you know, he gets his Border Patrol guys down there and they provide a little footage to the news cameras of, look at that, we caught one. The reason why they're focusing their efforts on that is because they don't want to point out the fact that labor is a supply and demand market. We've always known this in the United States. It's one of the reasons why we've historically used tariffs to keep domestic industries domestic so that there would be jobs for everybody. We didn't just want to protect the domestic industries so that the people owning the companies would be able to make a living. We also wanted them to be, you know, to be hiring. We wanted there to be a middle class in America. Of course, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton and Bush did away with that. GATT, NAFTA, all this other nonsense. But it's very simple. If you have a lot of workers, the cost of labor goes down, which is the whole con thing. So they're encouraging illegal immigration, and they're not prosecuting employers who hire illegals. I mean, it's a problem that has such a simple solution, such a very simple solution. But the cons are unwilling to even go there because it might diminish the profits of the big corporations that are using illegal labor. It would help rebuild the American middle class, but no, it would reduce corporate profits. Can't have that. At the same time, I mean, you got to get that this is part of a larger picture. There is this overall conservative worldview that envisions an America that no longer has a middle class, where if you want health insurance, you got to have a job. If you lose your job, you lose your health insurance, and then your pre-existing conditions, they'll never be covered again. So you're terrified to do anything that'll upset your employer. You know, another thing that, you know, makes the conservatives very happy because they're on the sides of the employers and of the inherited wealth of multinational corporations. Very simply, very straightforward. Henry Livingston now. Excuse me, Bob Livingston. Former Congressman Bob Livingston. He's come up with a new theory about all of this. It's all Bill Clinton's fault. That and more right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I get so lost sometimes.
And welcome back, my friends. Well, I'm not lost at all. I'll tell you, it is so obvious to me what the Bush administration is up to. And the deficit now, it's all Clinton's fault. Bill Clinton, the first president to produce a surplus in the memory of anybody alive. I mean, we generated a deficit as the result of the Revolutionary War. We sort of dug out of that. We generated a revolution a deficit as a result of the Civil War. We had to borrow money for that. We generated a deficit as a result of World War I, World War II. We went badly in debt for, but we had never ever exceeded $1 trillion in debt. Never ever. We had never accumulated a total of debt of even $1 trillion until Ronald Reagan came along with this half-baked, cockeyed idea that Alvin Lafler shared with him on a napkin over a cocktail and said, you know, if taxes are at zero, you will have no economic growth because you'll have no government, and you have to have a certain minimal amount of government in order to have economic growth, because you have to have a government to maintain currency and a court system to enforce contracts and things like that. Public roads and stuff like that. Without the infrastructure the government provides, business can't function. So you can't have taxes at zero. You'd have no economic activity. And you can't have taxes at 100%, because if 100% of your income is taxed, nobody would work. Those two things make sense. Now, keep in mind, at this time, the top marginal tax rate, in other words, if you the first in today's dollars, the first $20,000, $30,000 that you made was taxed at, you know, 8%, 10%. The next $30,000 more or less up to 15%, 20%. The next $30,000, you get up to around $100,000 in today's dollars back then, 1980. You would get into the, and this is all, I'm badly ballparking this, but it's a general range. You'd get up to around 20. Anyhow, it would slowly slide up to the point where if you were making $1 million a year, by the time you got to that $1 million, you would be paying 70% income tax rate. And the economy was booming. I mean, there had been, yeah, okay, there was a somewhat of a recession during the Carter years. This was the result of having borrowed like crazy during the LBJ and Nixon, and this was equally Democratic and Republican responsible. This is not a partisan issue, to pay for the Vietnam War. LBJ wanted to have guns and butter, just like Bush wants to. And so we borrowed like crazy, and so guess what? You end up with a you know, tough times as Carter's trying to pay these bills back. So anyhow, Reagan comes up with this cockamamie idea. If we lower taxes, then all those rich people, two things will happen. If rich people have more money, they will go out and buy more yachts, and that's going to generate more factories to build yachts and more stores to sell furs and whatever, and that's going to stimulate the economy. And, you know, there's some truth to that. It'll stimulate the economy slightly. Nothing even close to if you give money to working people. Because the problem is that you give money to a millionaire, you give extra money to a millionaire, and they're going to save it. They're not going to spend it. Because they're already, you know, their needs are already met. Which raises the second step, and that was that Reagan suggested, Lavler suggested, that you give money to these millionaires, and what they'll do, and billionaires, what they'll do is they'll use that money to invest in businesses to make more money, and those businesses will employ people. Well, this is where it really gets bizarre. Nobody, with the possible exception of George W. Bush when he was a young man, nobody has ever started a business simply because they had the money to start the business. People start a business because they see a market opportunity. They start a business because there's demand for a product or service. And if you can demonstrate that there's demand for a product or service and you've got a good idea for a business, you don't need to have cash. You can find venture capitalists who will back you. You can do it out of your... My first business I started with my unemployment check. And that company, within a year, I was making more money than my father had ever made in his lifetime on an annual basis. And that's what you can do. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, but that's the point. If you can find that there's demand for a product, you can start a business and you can make a living. But no, Reagan thought, no, you just give rich people money and they'll go and start a factory. Well, actually, there was a little bit of truth to that. You give millionaires and billionaires a tax cut, and they will open a factory sometimes as an investment. They just won't do it here in the United States. They'll do it in China, where labor's cheaper, or in Mexico. And so Reaganomics devastated America, began the systematic dismantling of the American middle class, and Bushonomics is just Reaganomics gussied up. It's the same thing. And in the midst of this comes along Bill Clinton, and he says, you know, we really ought to have a balanced budget. And Bill Clinton actually reduced the size of the federal workforce. He reduced it by 377,000, the lowest number of federal workers since 1960. Under every Republican administration, the federal workforce has grown. Under Clinton's administration, it actually declined. It actually shrank. And, but the cons, they got their spin on this thing. Here's Bob Livingston, former congressman.
I think that the president is right that we do have to cut unnecessary spending.
No, oh, we've got to cut unnecessary spending. Like, how about paying Halliburton $150,000 per person per year for to serve food and lines in Baghdad? No, that's not what he's talking about, obviously. He's talking about stuff like Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. You think it's possible?
But unfortunately, you know, we had a tremendous amount of burden that was handed to us by the Clinton administration.
A burden? You mean the first surplus since World War I?
With the growth of the government scandals.
Growth of the government? Excuse me, Clinton actually reduced government by 377,000 workers. These guys just lie with such facility. It's amazing.
9/11, the terrorist action, which was due to the growth of the very radical Muslim element and led by Osama bin Laden,
who's still on the loose. And by the way, 9/11 did not diminish our economy. 9/11 actually stimulated our economy. It's in a very significant way. There was a short-term, you know, minus impact in New York, but then there's the rebuilding, and then there's this huge security. I mean, George W. Bush has spent almost $1 trillion so far as a result of 9/11, creating all of these agencies and all of it, and all of that stuff stimulates the economy. Anyhow, back to Bob Livingston.
Which we could have taken out back in the last decade. So we have all these problems that have cropped up on us. Nobody predicted that they'd all come to a head during the Bush presidency, but I think he's right. We got through those problems in the past because he cut taxes.
Yeah. And then on he goes. But, you know, bin Laden, yeah, we should have taken care of him during the last decade. In other words, it's Clinton's fault. And, yeah, the size of government, yeah, it's Clinton's fault. It's all Clinton's fault. They're back to it. Do you believe this? I mean, I'll be the first to say there's a few things I'll blame Bill Clinton for, but having a budget deficit is not one of them. It's absolutely, absolutely mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number here on the Tom Hartman radio program. It's 42 and a half minutes past the hour. And Dince in Shannock, am I pronouncing all of that correctly?
Yes, sir.
Hey, what's up, Dince?
I like your thoughts. I'd like to ask you a couple
questions.
Excuse
me, Dince, where is Neshannock?
It's next to Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Continue with Newcastle.
Okay, great.
Bush is now talking about how he's going to redevelop, repopulate the Gulf Coast. And everyone's saying, well, how is he going to pay for this? And I was just wondering, it seems to me I heard that the top 1% of the people in the United States in income will receive $600 billion through his tax break over the next 10 years. Why couldn't he roll that back?
It may be actually more than that. It's going to be $335 billion over the next 5 years. Yeah.
And I have $600 billion over the next 10 years.
Yeah, that makes sense. My guess is it's actually going to be more than that, but I'll go with that number. Yes, he could roll that back. He could. And, in fact, that's only rolling back the last tax cut.
Right.
Right? I mean, we're talking $2 trillion if you want to roll back all of the tax cuts. And let's go back to the way taxes were under Bill Clinton, and maybe we can get back to the kind of economy we had under Bill Clinton.
That's a good thought, and I think that's the last time that we've seen any prosperity. But they want to talk about how he lied under oath. They don't want to talk about the job that he did. This man in the White House now lied to get a lot of young men and ladies killed, and no one says a word. But it seems to me that would be grounds for impeachment.
Yeah.
He virtually lied.
It's outrageous. I mean, you get Bob Livingston going on this rant about Clinton could have taken out bin Laden.
The very radical Muslim element and led by Osama bin Laden, which we could have taken out back in the last decade.
Okay, so he blames that on Clinton. But when Clinton tried to kill bin Laden, when he bombed bin Laden's place, missed him by 30 minutes,
right.
The same congressman, Bob Livingston, gets up on the floor and says, quote, to invert a phrase, life often imitates art, and Wag the Dog was a popular movie 6 months ago. In other words, Clinton's trying to kill Osama bin Laden so that people won't pay attention to his problems with Monica Lewinsky.
I understand. But that's their focal point. And now, of course, they use that against Hillary, and they get personal. Bill Clinton should have said in the very beginning that it's a personal matter, and I'm not going to discuss it, and that should have been the end of it.
Well, he tried to.
As Bush did. When he tried to talk to Bush about his escapades and dancing naked on tables.
Yeah, I mean, Bush still hasn't answered the question about his use of cocaine and his having to do community service work for it back in the 1970s. It's fairly well documented. So,
exactly.
Yeah, good point, Dince. And the reality in answer to your original question of how are they going to pay for it, they're going to borrow more money from our grandchildren. And this year, imagine if you had to go out and borrow money to pay the minimum balance on your credit card, which is all interest, you'd be in pretty bad shape, right? This year, we're going to borrow $300 billion just to pay the interest on the national debt. We got a problem. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
In the good old U.S.
USA. I'd just like to say, tomorrow's dreams are always coming true.
And welcome back, my friends.
Blessed world, all the little
Tom Hartman here with you, 50 and a half minutes past the hour, 9.5 minutes before. Folks in the chat room, you can get to the chat room, by the way, by going to TomHartman.com. Folks in the chat room discussing, what was that number that Reagan borrowed? Well, yeah, of course, Katrina has nothing to do with the number that Reagan borrowed. Reagan took us past $1 trillion and into the $2 trillion range, nudging into the $3 trillion range in debt. Ronald Reagan ran up more debt than every other president in the history of the United States, including all the wars that we fought combined. And the only way that he could keep the government from going just belly up on that thing was to borrow from the Social Security Trust Fund, which was created in 1982 to double tax the baby boomers so that the baby boomers would not only pay for the retirement of their parents and grandparents, but that they would also pay for their own retirement. The baby boomers, the first generation, asked to pay for their own retirement in addition to the retirement of the previous generations by being double taxed. Started in 82, they doubled the FICA tax, the Social Security tax, and created this huge trust fund. $2 trillion so far, almost $3 trillion so far has been put into that trust fund, and $3 trillion nearly so far has been taken out of that trust fund and spent by Reagan, Bush Sr., for much of the Clinton administration, by Clinton, and by George W. Bush. And what's left, IOUs for it. Anyhow, so the amount that we're going to spend this year on interest on the debt that Reagan ran up is $160 billion. The interest and our total interest payment this year is going to be over $300 billion because there's more debt that's been run up since Reagan. And we are borrowing all of the money that we are using to pay the debt. In other words, we're adding to our debt by borrowing the money to pay the interest on the debt. That, in my world, is the definition of bankruptcy. Brought to you courtesy of Ronald Reagan and conservative economics. Pure and simple. Ann in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Ann, what's up?
Well, I kind of take a different perspective on what these people are doing, because you have to look at their mindset, and because from our standpoint it looks like insanity, but from their mindset, their goal is to get rid of all entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare and workers' comp and unemployment benefits and those kind of things, because they basically want the same system here as over in China, where, by the way, they're sending all of our jobs and doing all their manufacturing. Is they want us to work for low wages, no benefits, and you're just going to have to fend for yourself as you get older, or maybe try to get your local governments to
right. And then you have a compliant workforce, and you have a workforce that doesn't get politically active because they're scared to death to do so.
Right. Well, it's kind of like the standard thing that they came, you know, that thing where they came for the Catholics, they came
right.
for the this, and
Pastor
I
Nehemiah,
that.
Yeah, first they came,
well,
yeah.
Yeah, so they came for the production workers' jobs, but I wasn't a production worker, so I didn't care. Then they came for the computer jobs. Well, you know, now I'm getting concerned. Oh, wait a minute. Now they're after all the they're going after everything except the lowest level service jobs, because anything to do with customer service, secretarial office, accounting, all that can now go overseas. They're even reading x-rays and stuff overseas.
Yeah,
now.
Absolutely. A great point, and thank you for making it. In fact, AJ Montini of the Arizona Republic, the brilliant columnist of the Arizona Republic, posted on his website, wrote an op-ed piece about a voicemail he received, and posted this voicemail on his website, from an anonymous caller to his answering machine.
2 minutes. To listen, press zero.
I'm calling in, and I'm promising myself not to cry, but y'all's right about things that are going on in the current events. I'm wondering, has anybody noticed in America, all of us that are unemployed? I'm 43 years old, and I've been working since I was 16. My husband is 45. We've been married 22 years. And we've always worked. A year ago, I lost my job. 6 months ago, his job was outsourced to India. We have 3 children. One that's 18, and we were going to try to help them get through college. But anyway, I just wondered, there's so many of us, and people, that don't seem to notice what's going on. And nobody, you see, like I read the paper and I don't see a lot of people writing about it. And I know there's a lot of them out there because I talk to my friends every day that I used to work with, and there are no jobs. And it just seems like somebody ought to write that a lot of jobs have gone overseas, and there's no jobs in this country for people that have worked all their lives. And, I mean, yesterday I was on the phone looking around for shelters because we've got another 2 months before we're going to get thrown out of our house. And we were part of that middle class section there. This wasn't, I mean, I never thought this was supposed to happen to us. And I know there's a lot of people out there like us. So anyway, it'd be neat if somebody would write and make the country aware that, I mean, I feel like invisible. You go to the grocery store and it's like, see, we were an invisible section, but I think there's like millions of us. So anyway, somebody ought to write about it. And you always write about everything and you make it good. And nobody hears us. So I...
To respond or forward.
That from A.J. Montini, Arizona Republic. And you can find a link to that. You go to TomHartman.com into our message board, and there's a link to the article that he wrote, which was brilliant, an absolutely brilliant article about in response to that phone call. And that is the result of Reaganomics. What you are seeing right there, Reaganomics at work, combined with Bill Clinton's having signed NAFTA and GATT with so-called free trade. You take so-called free trade and Reaganomics, Bushonomics, conservative economic policies, and the destruction of trade unions in this country, and the removal of tariffs in this country, and that is what you get, the destruction of the American middle class. Pure and simple. It's absolutely predictable. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith and other competent economists running around saying, hey, this is what... Ross Perot saying, this is what's going to happen. It wasn't like it was a secret. And here we are. Well, it's time to throw the bums out. Get out there. Get politically active. We've got to do it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. Bill Clinton, speaking of smart people, Rhodes Scholar Bill Clinton launches withering attack on Bush. On Katrina? No, not just Katrina. On Iraq? No, not just Iraq. On the budget? No, not just on the budget. On all three! Breaking with tradition, under which U.S. presidents mute criticisms of their successors, Clinton said the Bush administration had decided to invade Iraq virtually alone and before U.N. inspections were completed, with no real urgency, no evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction. End quote. Finally, somebody's saying, somebody other than Howard Dean is saying. Howard Dean has been saying it all along. But, you know, the media, by and large, ignores Howard Dean. Tragically. Howard Dean, another man who would make a marvelous president of the United States. A Dean Edwards ticket. I think, in my opinion, a Dean Edwards ticket, or Edwards Dean for that matter, could be one of the best things that could happen to this country. George W. Bush. Bill Clinton goes on to say, the Iraq war diverted U.S. attention from the war on terrorism and undermined the support we might have had with the rest of the world. He was speaking over the weekend on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. He said, heroic but so far unsuccessful effort to put together a constitution. Well, now the constitution is together and we discover that they're creating a Supreme Court that can strike down any law if it doesn't agree with Sharia law, if it's not Islamic. It's just, it's outrageous. It's outrageous what the Bush administration has done and has gotten away with. Although, I'm telling you, the tide is turning. Increasingly, they are not getting away with it. The American people are seeing through it. The spin and the lies aren't working anymore. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, say hi, participate. Bill in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? Hey, the thing is, did you notice what John McCain said the other day about his solution to the budget crisis? He wants to take the money that they were going to spend on prescription drugs for Medicare. He wants to take that money and use it to, you know, pay for the Katrina reconstruction.
Right.
Why is it the Republicans, they always go for people in this country who actually need help?
Well,
always want to cut their help.
You have to understand, Bill, the original reason why that drug benefit was put into the Medicare bill. People are going, you know, why would George W. Bush put a $300 billion drug benefit into Medicare when his whole entire life has basically said there shouldn't be any Medicare? Well, that's why they put it in. That's why they specifically put in the clause that said that the federal government cannot negotiate with the drug companies, because they knew that once that thing kicked in, all it would take was maybe 2 years, 3 years of that $300 billion a year bill coming due, and the federal government would look around and go, this thing is bankrupting us. This is unsustainable. You think you got a crisis with Social Security. You've got a disaster with Medicare because you can't negotiate with the drug companies. So for a pill that you should be able to buy at wholesale for 5 cents, you have to pay $8. And, you know, as a result of that, and I'm serious. I mean, you know, the real quantities. And as a result of that, it was a poison pill, no pun intended, that they put into the Medicare bill. It was designed to destroy Medicare. And all John McCain is doing is just moving the rhetoric up about a year.
Yeah, it amazes me that they actually made it a part of the law that the federal government can't negotiate prices with the drug companies, that they have to pay full price.
Yeah.
How in the hell do they get away with taking our money and giving it to the drug companies like they need any more of our money?
They get away with it. They get away with it because the media doesn't report on it. The media doesn't report on it because they have interlocking boards of directors with the drug companies. It's
right.
It's all one big happy family. The corporate, political, industrial, military complex. It's all one big happy family. And it's time for us to be going back to what Senator Sherman from Ohio said in 1881, in December of 1881, when he introduced the Sherman Antitrust Act, that it is time to start breaking up some of these big companies. The last president to have the chutzpah to do it was Jimmy Carter. And breaking up AT&T. And actually, let's give Jerry Ford some credit. That was actually started under Jerry Ford and the Ford and Carter administrations, a Republican and a Democrat, who both believed in that at a certain point, corporations would get so large that they could be destructive to democracy itself, which was the original point of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Ronald Reagan came along, and his philosophy, the con philosophy, is let the Republicans, let the corporations rule.
Absolutely.
Very simple.
Well, look what,
very simple.
Unfortunately, look what Bill Clinton did with the Telecommunications Act, deregulation.
Yeah.
Absolutely destroyed any idea of a free press that we have as far as the mainstream media goes.
Yeah, it didn't destroy it, but it put a nail in the coffin, a substantial one, one of the very largest of them. I agree. And what it was a follow-on to Ronald Reagan's 1987 efforts, when he did away with the Fairness Doctrine and a whole lot of other things associated with it that get a lot less press but really were more important, that had to do with community service requirements. Bill, I got to move along. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Thank you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Chris in Franklin, Tennessee. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I really enjoy listening to your show.
Thank you.
I just had three real quick comments. I live in Tennessee, which is the reddest, feels like the most ignorant state in the union.
I don't think so. You know, you got a lot of good people in Tennessee who vote Democratic, who understand the issues. But there are people, however, unfortunately, who get sucked in by the wedge issues. But, you know, they're afraid of gays, or they think that,
exactly.
The Democrats are going to come take your Bible away or whatever. And all of which is rather tragic
it's
and silly.
Funny.
Yeah.
But, I remember back in the 90s, the neo-theo-fascicons would tell me that the Clinton economy was because of Reagan and Bush.
Right.
And, it's just amazing to me that these people just drink the Kool-Aid. And, you know, I've been wondering over the last 4-plus years, who are they going to blame all of this mess on? Of course they're going to blame it on Bill Clinton.
Of course.
Everything is going to be Bill Clinton's fault.
Here is Bill Livingston, just, you know, one more time, just because it's always, you know, it's always so fun to listen to these guys.
I think that the president is right that we do have to cut unnecessary spending. But unfortunately, you know, we had a tremendous amount of burden that was handed to us by the Clinton administration with the growth of the government scandals. 9/11, the terrorist action, which was due to the growth of the very radical Muslim element and led by Osama bin Laden, which we could have taken out back in the last decade.
So there you go. It's all Clinton's fault. Everything.
Exactly.
It's all Clinton's fault.
The same people who want to cut all of the social programs that vote Republican are the exact same individuals who will jump at those programs when they need them.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the tragedy of it.
That
you're absolutely right, Chris. You're absolutely right.
And I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Chris.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I mean, and that's the tragedy of it. And it really is tragic that people are actually being harmed. I mean, George W. Bush comes along and he says, oh, I'm a compassionate conservative. What does that mean? It means he's going to transfer $1 billion a year to churches. Very large, wealthy white churches and very influential black churches who can deliver votes to him. That's what he's going to do. And he calls that compassionate conservatism. He's going to talk about 1,000 points of light. In other words, if you want something done, you got to depend on rich people to give money to charities to take care of you. What? We take care of ourselves? Through this thing called government? No, can't do that. Ed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Yeah, a couple of questions concerning the Bush administration's outing of the undercover CIA agent.
Yeah.
But before I get to that, I do want to take issue with you on whether or not the media gave us information regarding this poison pill called the Medicare drug benefit.
Yeah, you know, it was reported on it.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it wasn't reported on the way it should have been, and I don't think most Americans realize why it was put in there.
Okay, but anyhow, back to the CIA agent thing. Now, I have two questions. Fitzgerald, who's in charge of this investigation, has he been given a target date for completing his investigation?
His budget runs out either at the beginning or end of October. I don't remember which, but it's October.
Okay.
Next month.
Okay, that's number one. Number two, and I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say about this, but the Democratic Party, I happen to be a Democrat, by the way.
Good on
you. The Democratic Party, what have they done with respect to this opportunity to expose this administration and its treachery against our own country with regard to this CIA agent thing? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, you don't even have to hang up, Ed. I'll tell you, we've got 10 seconds before we got to take a break anyway. And it's a quick answer. They've done very, very little. And it's a tragedy that the Democratic Party has become so emasculated. They've become so terrified of the Karl Rove-type Republicans that they're afraid to speak up. They let the Republicans run roughshod and play politics all the time. They're saying, hey, it's no time to play politics. Republicans playing the blame game while they're saying, hey, it's no time to play the blame game. And it's the Bob Schrum and the DLC sellout Democrats who have had so much influence in the party. And frankly, you know, we got to do something about that, too. But that, in its time, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall.
Welcome back, my friends.
The cabaret was quiet, except for the drilling in the wall.
Richard Pombo.
The cap had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway, looking like the Jack of Hearts.
Richard Pombo and the Jack of Hearts, Tom DeLay. The New York Times reports this morning that House Resources Committee Chairman Richard Pombo, Republican of California, has proposed gutting, essentially, the Endangered Species Act. Now, this shouldn't surprise you, Richard Pombo, a guy who takes money from Tom DeLay's arm pack and then votes with Tom DeLay 95% of the time. Basic government for hire. Pombo voted to weaken the ethics rules in a move that served only to protect Tom DeLay. When Republicans realized it was impossible to win the communications battle over the gutted ethics rules, Pombo flip-flopped, voted to put the old rules back into place. Yeah, he cares about the House integrity once the cable news starts covering it. Democrats offered a solution to clean up the House by strengthening the effort rules. Combo voted twice to make sure that it never even came up for a vote. And then he contributes to DeLay's defense fund an amount of money just by coincidence equal to the amount of money that he got from Tom DeLay's illegal pack, arm pack, that is now under indictment. Richard Pombo, Republican cretin of the day? I don't know. I don't want to get into name-calling. Richard Pombo, our Republican of the day. How's that? He's doing what Republicans do. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Well, yes, hey, that is it's just a fascinating story. Just unbelievable. Really quite extraordinary. Because it's not being talked about much in Washington, D.C., because people are afraid that maybe one of their own infractions and transgressions is going to come up. So it'll be interesting to see, I think, whether the news actually makes something of this. What is up today in Washington, D.C., because the president's out of town in Louisiana, shoring up his image and doing the other things he feels he has to do, is the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing this morning on the Supreme Court's Kelo decision.
So the Kelo decision, for our listeners who may not know, is the recent decision, it was just a few months ago, in which the Supreme Court ruled that eminent domain, under the Fifth Amendment, it says that the government can't take your property without compensating you for it, and that it must be for a public purpose. And eminent domain it used to mean things like building a road or a fire station. And public purpose was expanded somewhat in the 70s and 80s to include things like tearing down slums, urban renewal, and that passed the Supreme Court test. And now the Supreme Court has expanded it even further to say that if you've got a business, you know, a fine, healthy, thriving business that's producing, say, $10,000 a year in taxes, and Walmart comes along and says, hey, let us have that land, we'll produce $100,000 a year in taxes, then the local county or state or city government can take your property away, bulldoze it, sell it to Walmart. They still have to compensate you for the land, but, you know, you've lost your business, for example, or you've lost your home, as the case may be. And a lot of people, both on the left and the right, think that this was just a wrong decision.
Absolutely. In fact, as one of the sound men who was there recording it for his organization said to me afterwards, he said, that's just messed up, man.
Yeah.
Which I think pretty much sums it all. Now, one thing I found interesting and a little disturbing was that of the Senate Judiciary Committee members, Patrick Leahy, the ranking Democrat, was there. Many of the Republicans were there. There were no other Democrats there whatsoever. They didn't show up at all.
That's odd.
And I think that is very disturbing.
That's very odd. This was for a hearing on Kelo.
Yes, this was the hearing on Kelo. In fact, Suzette Kelo, the woman who is the center of the case, she came. She testified. She told her story, which is just outrageous. And they were not there. They didn't participate in the questioning, with the exception of Patrick Leahy. This, I'm afraid, gives the impression to the American people that they supported the decision.
Can you find out why they weren't there? I mean, was there some big vote going on? Was there something really important? Was a Democratic caucus meeting?
I don't know of the Democratic caucus meeting, but you know, these are big guys who sort of go in and out of things. They could at least have come in for their 5 minutes of questioning.
Right.
We're going to try and find out, but I think they're going to come up with all kinds of reasons. Yes, there was a vote, but the way the hearing was scheduled was that it ended in time for everybody to be able to go and vote. So it's certainly not that there was a vote. It did not look good. It did not look good.
That's a tragedy, because the cons, I mean, starting with Limbaugh, have been painting the Kelo decision as the liberals on the court. Of course, most of them were appointed by either Reagan, Ford, or Bush. But nonetheless, they're the liberals on the court who did this. And as I said, I don't know of any, quote, liberals, end quote, who agree with the Kelo decision.
No, with the exception of John Paul Stevens.
Yeah, well,
who wrote it,
yeah.
Yeah.
and I think, it wouldn't surprise me if he's starting to regret it, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know whether he is. Certainly, they didn't indicate this morning that he was. There are various readings of the law, and there were certainly a couple of witnesses to testify that the law was absolutely right in its understanding. But then, when you hear these stories, the difference between taking something to build a hospital and taking it to just develop it,
yeah,
is quite unbelievable.
It's night and day. It's
disturbing.
Yeah, it's just plain old flat out wrong. And Congress can remedy that, and they can do it fairly easily. And if the Republicans get out ahead of the curve on this, well, I'd say good on them for doing it. But it's a lost opportunity for the Democrats. They're probably listening to Bob Shrum again. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks for the report from Washington, D.C., Victoria. Good talking with you. We'll see you tomorrow. Richard Pombo, Tom DeLay. We're going to get back to your calls right after. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, in a way it's not. Here we have the James Baker. You'll remember James Baker. He's the guy who fought so hard down in Florida in 2000 to help George W. Bush steal an election from Al Gore that Al Gore rightfully won. When they finally got around to counting every vote in the state of Florida, they discovered Al Gore actually got more votes than George W. Bush. And the New York Times and the Washington Post both ran stories about it a year and a half later. Unfortunately. James Baker, the guy down there initiating the lawsuit, Bush versus Gore, George W. Bush suing Al Gore to stop the vote and make himself president. A challenge taken up by several appointees of his daddy. So anyhow, James Baker and Jimmy Carter. I am afraid, tragically, that Jimmy Carter has been snookered big time on this thing. James Baker and Jimmy Carter formed this commission to look into voting irregularities. And what do they come up with? That the voting machine should have paper trails. Right. So, you know, for example, in Nevada in 2004, the voting machines had paper trails. One side had a problem with the way the vote came out. They thought there was fraud. They thought the machines had been hacked. They said, let's compare the paper trails with what the computer said. And the state said, no, you can't do that. Same thing in Ohio in this recent election. The recent congressional election where the Marine was running. Well, he lost by more than the 3% margin, so we can't look at that paper. What's really going on here is the privatization of our vote. It is that is the true felony against democracy. The real felony against democracy is that the commons by which all of the other commons are administered, our vote, has been privatized. Roughly 80% of the vote in America right now is counted on a machine from a private corporation that will not tell you how they count that vote. You cannot look at the software. They invoke trade secrecy laws and corporate personhood and say, nope, you can't know about it. And so this report just came out, and what are they calling for? National ID cards for everybody, which is going to be a terrible burden for the elderly and for the poor. In Georgia, for example, if you don't have a driver's license, you can get an ID card for $25. The only problem is, in the city of Atlanta, there's no place where you can go and get one. I mean, I think of my mother, who's in her 70s and hasn't driven in probably 40 years, doesn't have a driver's license any longer. What's she going to do? And so that's their solution. And is it a big problem? People voting who actually aren't credentialed. I mean, there's all this hysteria about illegal immigrants in the United States. Do you really think illegal immigrants are so worked up about American politics that they're going to make it to the polls? Somehow I doubt it. No, in fact, what we're finding is that it's really a non-problem. The big problem is folks like Kenneth J. Blackwell and the actually, he's not the only one. Many of these secretaries of state, the Republican secretaries of state, purging the voting rolls. Kathleen Harris down in Florida, the same thing, purging the voting rolls largely of African Americans. Blackwell knocking something like 100,000 people off the voting rolls in the year before the 2004 election. Why? Because they hadn't voted in the last national election. They were still legal and eligible, and also, nope, kick them off the rolls. So Carter and Baker have solved a non-problem, and they're saying voting machines should have a paper trail. Sure enough, well, that sounds nice, but you still have the voting machine, and it's still owned by a private corporation, and the state is still free to pass laws, or the Secretary of State is still free to enact rules that say that you can't look at that paper trail. So why have it? It's Looney Tunes, my friends. It's absolutely Looney Tunes. Scott in Seattle, Washington, on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
What I'd like to say is that what really perplexes me about the current news coverage on Hurricane Katrina is the fact that I have not heard even one comment about how the gay populations of that area are faring in this hurricane. And that furthermore, these efforts that the TV networks are making to reunite families separated by evacuation, that whenever a family is mentioned, it's always a traditional type of family.
Somebody called this program 4 days ago or so, 5 days ago, last week, with a similar question, Steve. Yeah, I don't remember what his name was, but
It was me.
Oh, it was you. Okay, and I asked you then at the time. You said that you were reading the gay blogs and you got gay publications and you were connected into the gay community. And I said, would you please ask that community or find out, you know, what's going on in that community if there is, you know, some sort of apparent intentional, you know, if there's a real problem here, or if it's just, you know, that the gay community is not being disproportionately impacted like the poor black community is. What have you found?
Well, I did send an express mail letter to the advocates suggesting that as a news topic, but I guess really though what I kind of wonder is why does something like this about the gay population need to be covered by the alternative press rather than the Associated Press, the UP, and
yeah.
such.
No, I'm not suggesting that it should be. My guess, frankly, Scott, is that in the black community, by and large, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I have some connections in all of these communities and have over my life. My sense of it is that in the black community, it's much more difficult to be out about being gay. There is, you know, being gay is much more disapproved of in the black community than in the white community. And so, and in the white community, in New Orleans did not, I mean, everybody suffered terribly and lost their homes and things, but most of the white community had the means to get out of town. And which would have included the visible part of the gay community, whereas the invisible part of the gay community, the gays who are black, they aren't all of a sudden when the storm hits going to pop up and, you know, if they weren't going to come out before and say, hey, guess what? By the way, I'm gay, too, and I'm homeless after the storm. And so I think that kind of odd socio-demographic, whatever you want to call it, cultural phenomena may account for the lack of that particular community being defined. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I know that here in Seattle that there are an awful lot of gays that are dependent upon public transportation for transportation needs, that they certainly don't have, like, private cars and such.
No, I understand that, but I'm guessing that probably they're proportionate to the general population. You know, that the percentage of gays who need public transportation is whatever percentage it is. Let's just arbitrarily say it's 3%, and 3% of the general population needs public transportation, or 5 or 10 or 20 percent, whatever it may be. That it's probably proportionate. That there's not that big a difference in that particular arena. I mean, I may be wrong on this, and hopefully I'm not propagating stereotypes here of some sort or misinformed. But my guess is that that the population that was most seriously impacted by this thing, and that we're seeing the most about in the press, is the poor black population. And even the poor white population has not been getting that much attention, frankly, down there. And in the black community, being gay is very, very difficult to be gay and to be out. And
yes,
and so that's my guess about why you're not seeing, you know, it being talked about, because the people who are, you know, gay and black and being impacted by this are not discussing the fact that they're gay. They're just, you know, another person who's lost in the crowd, as it were.
But with so very much being said about what's happening down there, wouldn't you think that there would be at least one comment about the gay population?
Well, there have been two on this radio program. I mean, you know, it's a beginning.
Where else?
I haven't seen it, Scott, and I acknowledge that.
That's the problem.
And as I said, if you learn anything at all, let us know, okay?
All righty, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Steve, a truck driver in Mississippi. Hey, Steve, what's up?
How you doing? You're not going to believe this. I'm a lifelong Republican, and I believe it's time to cut the tax cut in half.
Cut the tax cut in half. Good on you. You know, it's like, let's just go back to taxes the way they were under Bill Clinton so we can have the economy the way it was under Bill Clinton. After all, it was Republicans who set that up.
I'm going as far as now to say cut the tax cut in half, and I don't think that hurt the economy. We got all that spending going on.
Yeah, Steve.
Quite frankly, there's a lot of spending going on. It's
yeah. Steve, I'm sorry you're breaking up. We're losing you. But the reality is that the you know, cutting the tax cut in half, well, it's a drop in the bucket. But I'm telling you, the cons aren't even going to do that. They're pushing for more tax cuts. They want more tax cuts. They want to make in particular, the tax cut that says that if you earn your living sitting on your butt around the swimming pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive and you only have to pay 15% maximum income tax. Louise was telling me, by the way, yesterday, that the last check we got from Marriott, I bought one share of Marriott stock 15 years ago because they gave stockholders a 10% discount and I was doing a lot of traveling. So I bought one share. It cost me like $25. They send me a dividend. It's grown over the years. It's now like 2.5 shares. The last dividend was $1.10. I used to get these 10-cent checks every 3 or 4 months. On those checks, I only pay a 15% income tax, right? So now they're saying, let's make that permanent. In fact, let's cut it down to zero. So people who make their living getting dividend checks, they pay no taxes at all. That's what they want to do in response to Katrina. I think it's a little weird. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm sailing away.
No, no, stay here.
Set an open course for the Virgin Sea.
No, we need you. We need everyone here to vote.
I've got to be free.
Yeah, I know. And we'll only get our freedom back if we vote out the Bushies.
Free to face the light that's ahead of me.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. It is 9 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. It's the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some cranky right-wing think tank. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Melissa in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi.
I got a prediction.
Okay.
Bush and his cronies are going to hightail it back to Texas, and then Texas is going to secede. You know, it's got the right to do it. You know, after the Civil War, you know, they used to be a sovereign country. Well, they refused to rejoin the Union unless they could keep the right to leave it again.
Oh, really?
Really? And what better place is there to hide out but in your own country?
Oh, isn't that interesting? I didn't realize that Texas, uniquely among the 50 states,
yes,
Texas has the right to secede.
Yes. They're allowed to have their own Navy, which is the USS Texas, which is right now docked in cement. And they're allowed to have a lot of things because they used to be a sovereign country.
Right. The only two states that were sovereign countries before joining the United States were Texas and Vermont.
Right.
Interestingly enough.
Right. So check the Texas Constitution. I mean, these guys dream big. They've been ransacking the country. Why shouldn't they assume
well,
that they can take a state?
It's really interesting, Melissa, because, you know, you say that, and at first, you know, my first reaction to it was, you know, nice joke.
Uh-huh.
But think for a minute about all the billions of dollars that are being transferred from all over
yes.
the United States to
yes.
Texas.
They're
Halliburton
have the
is
money.
A Texas corporation. All this
mm-hmm.
money is going into Halliburton. You've got a whole bunch of other
mm-hmm.
Texas companies. All these Texas cronies
mm-hmm.
of George W. Bush are just all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It is,
these guys have been planning the South's revenge ever since Appomattox.
Incredible. Well, you may be right. You may be right. You know,
I lived in Texas for 17 years. To me, it's completely plausible.
Yeah, I can't discount it. I can't
yeah.
discount it. That's a great one. Melissa, thanks for the call and for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening on KTPK in Seattle area. Bill in Eureka, California on KGOE. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom,
yeah.
I heard your rant on your immigration a while ago.
Yeah, about an hour and a half ago, yeah.
And Ronald Reagan signed some legislation, the Naturalization Immigration Act, that put the burden on the employers to make sure that the people were eligible to work in this country. They had a green card or a Social Security card or something.
Right, but it's not enforced.
No, and they promptly quit funding any enforcement for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was working for a labor union at the time, and we were excited about that because we thought we could use that to help, fight the non-union because those are the kind of people that hire the illegal aliens because those are the kind of people they can exploit.
Sure, and are continuing to. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is you get Lou Dobbs, for example, on his show, and he's done one of the better jobs of highlighting this, and occasionally he'll have on the white racist, you know, and pander to them, unfortunately. But by and large, I think he gets it, although he doesn't come out and say it explicitly enough because he's a good Republican, I suppose. But the problem here is that people are hiring them. People are employing them. And if in the United States people didn't employ illegals, the illegals would leave because they wouldn't have a job opportunity, and then they can't go on welfare, or if they, you know, it's in some states I suppose they can, but it's getting more and more difficult, and there's a, you know, backlash against that, and you know, let's let Mexico deal with Mexico's problems. I don't mean to sound like an absolute nationalist or something like that. But the reality is that if a nation doesn't deal with its own problems, if it just offloads its problems onto other people, in this case, Mexico offloading its poverty and the fact that it's basically an oligarchic form of government where you've got 30 or so wealthy families that own most of the wealth in the country and a huge, you know, the huddled masses are, you know, enormous poverty. And then the influence of the Catholic Church making birth control very hard to use and scaring people that they'll go to hell if they use it anyway, you know, those problems that they have in Mexico should not be ours to deal with, frankly.
They shouldn't spill over to us. You're correct. But, you know, I talked to an employer one time out of Texas, and they said that the immigration came around and gave them a week's notice and said that they would be in there checking cards.
Yeah.
So that's their enforcement.
Yeah, well, and that's all the more the tragedy. Bill, thanks for the call.
Yeah. Thank you for your message.
You're welcome. And this is, again, this is neither right nor left. And what's bizarre to me, what's truly bizarre to me, is how those on the Reich have worked so very hard to try to cause Americans to think that for some reason liberals are in favor of illegal immigration. I don't know of any liberals or progressives who are in favor of illegal immigration. I mean, there are people who are out there saying, you know, people shouldn't die. If you have illegal immigrants who are working in fields where they're exposed to chemical, they shouldn't be exposed to those chemicals. Well, they shouldn't be working there in the first place. But these people are looking at, you know, the secondary issues. Or, you know, their kids shouldn't be punished. Well, I agree with all those things, but, you know, they shouldn't be here either. So, you know, but the cons, they're trying to make this into the conservatives are in favor of a law and order approach to this. They just want to take all those illegals and ship them back. Well, no, actually, they don't. They want to bring them into the Bracero program, the reinvented Bracero program, where they're basically chattel, where they're basically owned by their so-called employers. And we actually had this program in the United States in the 1950s and 60s, and it was a terrible, terrible thing. And we did away with it for that reason. And that's what Bush wants to bring back. Why? You have more cheap labor. It drives down the cost of labor. It makes corporations more profitable. And you can ship more money to Texas. Who knows? Oh, my goodness, my goodness. When will Americans wake up? I think slowly they are. I really, really think they are. I'm Tom Hartman, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Our program, the place where despair is simply not an option. You must get active, helping you win the water cooler wars every day.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, podcasting on Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. David Delholm is with us. David is president of the Public Service Research Foundation, nonprofit research and education organization concerned with public policy on those nasty unions. Right, David?
Very good, Tom. Yeah.
Okay. those nasty unions. Now, I understand that in your mind, the president just was absolutely right to suspend Davis-Bacon down in the Louisiana area and the areas that were afflicted by this storm.
Absolutely, no question about it.
Why is that?
Well, you got to understand the history of Davis-Bacon and how it worked. Davis-Bacon was enacted as it's a Depression-era law that was enacted in 1931 they said it was to prevent federal spending from influencing local economies. The real purpose of it was discrimination.
Yeah, the real purpose of it. It was passed by a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican President, Herbert
right.
Hoover.
And,
the real purpose was so that blacks would not be hired.
From getting the jobs that belong to white people.
That's right. You're absolutely right, yeah.
And look at the situation down there in the affected area.
But hang on just a second before we go blindingly from 1931 to 2005 here. Let's just take a second and notice that in 1931 segregation was not only legal, it was the law, and that in 1931 there were no legal protections for African Americans in the workplace. In fact, there were few legal protections for anyone. It was 1935 that the Wagner Act was passed that provided union protections to most Americans, and so. It worked very efficiently, very effectively to say, you know, we're going to pay the prevailing wage, the prevailing white wage, and that would lock blacks out of the workplace. But by the mid-1940s, it wasn't having that effect anymore.
It still does it. Let me give you a recent example. In 1993, a court case declared Michigan's state prevailing wage law to be a violation of the ERISA, the Employment Retirement Security Act. And it wasn't until 1997 that the courts then changed their mind and said, no, it's all right. Now, a study was done of employment in Michigan on public works projects during the period before and during and after the suspension of the prevailing wage law, and they discovered that the suspension of the prevailing wage law, or what accounted for repeal, really, correlated to a very strong increase in minority employment in construction. It's still doing it today. If there weren't a discriminatory effect of that law, the people who are supporting it wouldn't want it.
Wasn't the reason why that happened, though, that the unions, by and large, were reflect the times. Union membership reflects the times. The difference being that people who are members of unions, stay members of unions through generally through their entire working life, which is, you know, 20, 30, 40 years.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Well, many of them do, assuming that the jobs stick around. We had a fairly stable period of employment from the 1950s to the 1980s where people who had union jobs, I grew up in that world. My dad ran a tool and die shop in Lansing, Michigan, and everybody I knew was working at Oldsmobile, and, you know,
okay.
two of my brothers are union shop stewards. I have some familiarity with this. And during that time, even though discrimination had been outlawed, you know, starting with Brown versus Board of Education, and then in the 1960s in a more forceful way with the Voting Rights Act and other laws, even though discrimination had been outlawed, the unions, particularly in the North, as a result of legal discrimination in the 1940s, were largely white. And so as the unions, and what would happen was you had to wait for, because the job base, the union job base was not only not growing, it was shrinking starting in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan, you know, started, essentially declared war on unions. And we went from 25% unionization when Reagan came into office to where we're at the private workforce now, 8%. What was happening was that for blacks to get into a union, they had to wait for some white guy to die, which could be 30 years after.
No, because the president of the union made sure his son got in. They weren't waiting. They were being discriminated against.
No, the president of the union does not have a large enough family to provide, you know, 4,000 sons.
They're relatives and friends and union members, sons and daughters and whatnot, they were being discriminated against.
So you're suggesting that the unions are run sort of like the Bush family runs politics?
I'm not sure how that works, because I haven't
let me just finish this point. The point that I was making was that if in fact what you said, and I'm not disputing it, was that ending the prevailing wage law in Michigan caused African American employment in the construction trades to go up, I would suggest that increase in African American employment probably correlated with a decrease in union employment, and that the reason for that wasn't that the unions were being racist and overtly discriminating in the 1990s, but that they had been legally in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and that there's this one generation echo of that passes through the union movement, and that's, you know, fairly predictable. It's you can mathematically model that, and so. You know, which raises the larger question. The larger question that I have for you, David Delholm, and by the way, your website, psrf.org,
yeah, actually,
if people want more information.
Actually, it's Denholm. But
Denholm.
That's all right.
I'm sorry. I've got it written down here wrong. D-E-N-H-O-L-M?
You got it.
Okay. I'm sorry, David. Let me correct it as we speak. The question I have for you, David, is in the absence of unions, that is, without labor having some force or some power in the workplace, and in the absence of unions and in the absence of government rules such as minimum wage laws or prevailing wage laws, how can we have a middle class in the United States?
Very easily, and we're seeing it every day. In other words, look at America. And look at the fact that 7.8% of all private sector jobs are unionized, and that, as you pointed out, has been going down and down and down all this time.
And well, ever since 1980, yeah.
Well, ever since 1955.
No, actually, the peak of unionization was 1973, I believe, if you want to actually look at the numbers as a percentage.
In terms of absolute numbers, it goes down from 1980. Number, it was around 1973, but as a percentage, it was in 1955.
Okay, and we could probably track that back to the Taft-Hartley Act that was passed in 1947.
No, you could track it back to the War Labor Boards during the Second World War and the Korean War, where the federal government imposed unionism on anybody just to keep war production going.
I see. Okay. Well, in any case, so what you're saying is that we now have, as union, we had in the 1970s, you had 35% of the American workforce was unionized.
Right. And it
was 25% when Reagan came in.
The middle class is growing. Per capita income is growing. If what you say, that it was going to destroy the middle class, then wouldn't we see a decline in per capita income? Wouldn't we see a decline
But we are. After you adjust your dollars for inflation, and we have not seen any significant appreciation in per capita income since 1980.
I don't agree.
Well,
absolutely. I would be happy to share figures with you, but that's simply.
Why is it that half of America's children come home to an empty house now because it requires two families to produce the same income that one good union job could have provided 30 years ago?
Have you looked at what people are doing with the money? I mean, look at the, what you might call, the standard of living. Look at the cars, the houses, the vacations, and all of those things.
So it's all the fault of the consumers.
People want these things, and they're willing to work for them and willing to earn. And you can't blame that on the government.
So you think we're better off as a result of fewer union jobs being
absolutely
out there?
Yes.
And that's how, and the way that you'd build a middle class is by getting rid of the unions and getting rid of wage protections.
No, I don't think unions are getting rid of themselves.
Okay, but they, you know, whatever. If the unions get rid of themselves and wage protections go away, and you think that there'll continue to, that the middle class will grow as a result of that?
Yes, absolutely.
How?
Because of a growing economy. Because we have a better educated workforce all the time, because we are more productive all the time, because
But doesn't that productivity go into the pockets of the CEOs?
No. Come on.
Okay, I get it. Okay, good. David Delholm. Denholm. David, the president of the Public Service Research Foundation, PSRF.org. David, thanks for being with us today.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Much appreciated.
Bye.
It is 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. A net 382,000 private sector jobs have been lost since President George W. Bush took office. The wonders, absolute wonders, of the conservative workplace, conservative economic policies. By July 2005, 7.5 million were officially jobless, but experts estimate the total number of unemployed and underemployed at nearly 13.4 million. Since August 2001, worker productivity in the United States grew by 4.1%, while worker compensation grew only 1.5%, meaning workers received one-third of the benefits of increased efficiency. In the previous seven business cycles, workers gained about 75% of those benefits. Manufacturing jobs fell to 14.3 million in July of 2005, lower than July of 1945. The U.S. trade deficit is 14 times larger than in 1980. The trade deficit in goods grew to an estimated record $651 billion in 2004, or $1.78 billion a day. From 1994 to 2000, the trade deficit cost 3 million job opportunities and counts for at least 40% of the decline in real wages since the 1970s. Good jobs. America's middle class is absolutely under attack. I'm telling you, the cons want to take us back to the world of Scrooge and Marley. If you look at, for example, durable manufacturing, 893,000 jobs lost. Average wage $16.49. Those jobs are gone. Yeah, you can flip burgers for $6 an hour. Non-durable manufacturing, 390,000 jobs lost. Average wage $14.69. Yeah, you can flip burgers for $6 an hour. Information processing, average wage $21.29. 274,000 of those jobs gone. And on it goes. The top five gainers? Well, accommodations, working in the hotel industry. 180,000 jobs have actually been created. Average wage, $8.20 an hour. U.S. Department of Labor. Somebody sent me a link to this thing, but it is unreadable. I am sorry. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Shannon in Brainerd, Minnesota. Hey, Shannon, what's up?
Oh, boy. You know, that guy that you were just talking to made me see red.
Yeah, well, and, it's, you know, I didn't want to get into a shouting match with him because there's really no point in it. I mean, he's just, he was making my point for me. And
the guy's clueless. I mean, and he made me so frustrated that I completely forgot the point that I was going to make. I'm sitting here at my desk right now listening to you on iTunes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't worked in 2 months. I'm like this close to getting evicted from my apartment. I had to go make arrangements with my landlord recently. I can't find a job that pays more than $8 an hour, and I'm making more on unemployment than I would by taking a job making $8 an hour, so I'd be cutting my own throat to do so.
Well, and in much of America, $8 an hour will not pay for one person to survive, much less
right.
a family.
And I'm one person.
And it's not barely... and it's not like this guy said, oh, gee, you want to live in a McMansion. You know,
yeah.
It's not, I would guess, Shannon, that your problem is that you've got to have two new widescreen, high-definition TVs or something.
Oh, no, I got a crappy TV that I bought over in Korea when I was in the Army. I got to sell my truck, in order to survive right now.
Yeah, well, the Republicans would like you to know that the economy is doing just fine, thank you very much, and you're better off than you were before they came along.
Yeah, I'm a skilled laborer. I'm a broadband communications technician, mm-hmm. and I cannot find work.
Yeah.
Because there are two companies in town, and none of them have any jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
The wonderful IT industry for you right now.
Yeah.
Even a skilled laborer can't find a job.
Yeah. It's a tragedy, Shannon, and I wish you the best in finding something, but, all I can do is commiserate.
Pardon? I'll get by, and I always will, but getting by with the current economic system, I'm thinking about moving out of the state right now just to find work because that's what, you got to do what you got to do.
Yep, yep.
But you don't have to be happy about it.
Shannon, thanks for the call.
You bet.
Keep up the good spirits, my man. You'll find something there. Chris in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I'm with Local 46. We've got a few facts that we should cover real quickly about that last crack smoker. Republican gentleman.
Yeah.
And what happens is that at IBU 46, we actually in the 1880s realized we were just hurt by the kind of country club mentality that some of the unions were having.
Yeah.
So we started our Comet program to get people back into union. The reason we lost so many people partly is the continued attack on the trade by larger corporations. So none of the underprivileged people, namely Mexicans, blacks, and Asians, got to see families or parents or anybody else, so they knew trades could be a good job. But we have to go out there and preach to the people and educate them. And that's one of the things that's the hardest.
So you're doing outreach to minority communities to get them into the unions, in other words.
We outreach communities. We outreach our own folks to get them what we're doing for them.
Yeah.
The hardest part is keeping people...
And you know why it's such a hard thing, Chris, is because when I was growing up back in the old days, there used to be actually a labor section in the newspaper, and they talked about labor issues. And now that's gone. All they talk about is CEO compensation. Chris, thanks for the call. I got to move along. 27 past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend.
Yes, don't worry, my friends. Us Republicans will tell you everything is just fine. You're better off than you were before. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Everything is just fine. Everything is just fine. It's just absolutely great. Just absolutely great. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Joni in Renton, Washington. Hey, Joni, what's up?
Hey, Tom, this is Joni Job. I emailed you not too long ago to get you to play that great clip on that unemployed lady that had left a phone message.
Oh, and I played it in the first hour, didn't I?
Oh, well, that's a great one. But
it's a tragically great one, yeah.
as a young, I'm living that story at 52 years old.
I'm sorry to hear that.
That's okay. I've never been with a union. I've always been self-employed. Mm-hmm. And so there's no unemployment for the self-employed that are unemployed at this point.
Yeah.
But, and Denholm, I don't bear him any ill will. I guess he just is looking at Bush's figures rather than reading the book Greenspan's Fraud.
Yeah, which is a remarkable book, by the way, for our listeners who don't know. Ravi Batra wrote this great book, Greenspan's Fraud. But anyhow, so...
He explains it real clearly, but...
Yeah.
I guess, I'm just going to say, I and a whole collective lot of people were just so tired of the corruption in this administration.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of us feel like even our Democratic Congress people are not standing up for us and are not really doing too much for us. I just, you can go to voting, like, is it even worth your point to vote? Are they counting your votes? Is your vote going to be counted? Is it going to be hacked? I'm to the point of, I've got a solution. Let's just, everybody, if you could get everybody what you couldn't get the conservatives on this one, just don't vote. And, I'm to the point of, like, let's shut the system down. Let's all just stop going to work. Let's demand this administration's resignation. Shut the system down. Because every time that we go to work or try to make a dollar or doing anything in this system, just the corporations and this administration are pocketing it left and right.
Yeah, yeah, and you're absolutely right, Joni. Thanks for pointing that out and for the call. It's over the top. Here is from a Republican president of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, 1912. We are a business people. The tillers of the soil, the wage workers, the businessmen, these are the three big and vitally important divisions of our population. The welfare of each division is vitally necessary to the welfare of the people as a whole. The great mass of business is, of course, done by men whose business is either small or of moderate size. The middle-sized businessman forms an element of strength which is of literally incalculable value to the nation. Taken as a class, they're among our best citizens. They are not seekers after enormous fortunes. They have been moderately and justly prosperous by reason of dealing fairly with their customers, competitors, and employees. They're satisfied with a legitimate profit that will pay their expenses of living and lay by something for those who come after, and the additional amount necessary for the betterment and improvement of their plants. The average businessman of this type is, as a rule, a leading citizen of his community, foremost in everything that tells for its betterment. A man whom his neighbors look up to and respect. He is in no sense dangerous to his community, just because he is an integral part of his community, born of its bone and flesh of its flesh. His life fibers are intertwined with the life fibers of his fellow citizens. So much for the small businessman and the middle-sized businessman. Now let me speak to you of big business. Again, I'm quoting Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States, Republican. It is imperative, he said, to exercise over big business a control and supervision which is unnecessary as regards small businesses. All businesses must be conducted under the law, and all businessmen, big or little, must act justly. Big business in the past has been responsible for much of the special privilege which must be unsparingly cut out of our national life. I do not believe in making mere size of and by itself criminal. The mere fact of size, however, does unquestionably carry the potentiality of such grave wrongdoing that there should be by law provision made for the strict supervision and regulation of these great industrial concerns doing an interstate business, much as we now regulate the transportation agencies which are engaged in interstate business. The antitrust law does good insofar as it can be invoked against combinations which really are monopolies or which restrict production or which artificially raise prices. But the important thing is this, that under such government recognition as we may give to it that is beneficent and wholesome in large business organizations, we shall be most vigilant never to allow them to crystallize into a condition which shall make private initiative difficult. In other words, locking out the ability of small local entrepreneurs. I hate to sound like some old fart on the radio, but I remember when I was a little kid, when I was a teenager, I hitchhiked across the United States, and every single city was different. You travel across America now, every single city is the same. The big businesses have taken over. Back to Teddy Roosevelt. It is of the utmost importance that in the future we shall keep the broad path of opportunity just as open and easy for our children as it was for our fathers during the period which has been the glory of America's industrial history. That it shall not only be possible but easy for an ambitious man whose character has so impressed itself upon his neighbors that they're willing to give him capital and credit to start in business for himself. And if his superior efficiency deserves it, to triumph over the biggest organization that may happen to exist in his particular field. Whatever practices upon the part of a large corporation may threaten to discourage such a man, or deny to him, which in the judgment of the community is a square deal, should be specifically defined by the statute as a crime. And in every case, the individual large corporation officer responsible for such unfair dealing must be punished. Teddy Roosevelt, President of the United States, Republican. We grudge no man a fortune which represents his own power and sagacity, exercised with entire regard to the welfare of his fellows. We have only praise for the businessman whose business success comes as an incident of doing good work for his fellows. But we should so shape conditions that a fortune shall be obtained only in honorable fashion, in such fashion that its gaining represents benefit to the community. We stand, said Teddy Roosevelt, Republican president. We stand for the rights of property, but we stand even more for the rights of man. We will protect the rights of the wealthy man, but we maintain that he holds his wealth subject to the general right of the community to regulate its business use as the public welfare requires. The Republicans have changed their tune a bit, I would say. Since that day. Michael in Tokyo, Japan. Hey, Michael. Tokyo, Japan.
Yes. It's a real pleasure to... Well, I'm suffering from a bit of insomnia.
I was going to say, it's the middle of the night there. I assume you're listening on the web.
Yes. Actually, yes, that's exactly right. Usually I'll get it from the White Rose Society, but I decided to get it live tonight. I just couldn't sleep. But it's still very much a pleasure to have my call taking on your program.
Thank you for calling us.
A few minutes ago in the past, you've commented on the worsening position of the economy, and not the facade economy that, for example, the administration in power now has been setting forth, but what's going on underneath and the nature of the jobs that are being created and the twin deficits and the fact that, you know, that economic activity, most of it's based on debt. And It appears to me that this ultra-conservative agenda that you were just referring to some minutes ago, that it may actually come to pass, and that even as a progressive, if the progressive view is pushed forward in the next few years, then in the very near future, that may not even be able to stem the tide. And as a person that always tends to fear the worst, I know you're an optimist, at least that's the impression I get.
I am.
Yeah. I want to get your comment on how, because obviously there's going to be some clouds in the future, so how bad do you foresee it becoming in actual terms? Not that I expect you to be a prophet or anything
like
that. But
no. Well, one of the things, it's hard to say, Michael, and one of the things that concerns me is that I've spent a lot of my life working in the third world, and I've seen how much people will put up with before they revolt. And people will put up with an awful lot, frankly. And I think it's just a tragedy that there are even folks in the United States, even progressives, liberals, Democrats, whatever, who are saying, well, you know, if it gets bad enough, that let's just let it get worse and worse, and everybody will realize that Bush is nuts and that conservative economics destroy them. Well, the problem is that, spend some time in Colombia or in Mexico or in Nicaragua or, you know, in some of the African countries or, you know, some of the poorer of the Asian economies. And you'll see, you know, people will put up with an enormous amount of poverty. So, that I don't see as the solution. The solution that I think could and hopefully will happen is that people will get it that an economy... The purpose of an economy is to serve the people, not the other way around. That's the whole reason why we have economies. The whole reason why we essentially create an economy. And we do. Government creates an economy by creating currency and creating a court system that allows an economy to exist. The reason why we encourage people to do business is so that the general population is benefited. And the cons over the last 15 years, in particular, that right-wing talk radio has dominated, have flipped this upside down and caused so many people to think that if somebody employs you, for example, they are giving you a job. The reality is that if you're working for somebody, the only reason that they're giving you a paycheck is because they can make more money on you than they pay you. Otherwise, they wouldn't hire you. And so it's not that you know, somebody's giving you a job. It's that somebody is using you to make more money. And that's not, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship. We agree to get into those relationships. But I think that we need to change the paradigm. We need to flip this upside down and help people wake up. Is that making sense, Michael?
That makes quite a bit of sense.
Yeah. I in my mind, the solution is education. I'm sure you've seen that in Japan. The average Japanese is very aware of these kinds of issues in ways that the average American is not.
That's true.
Michael, thanks so much for the call. I got the tyranny of the clock here. I appreciate you taking the time to call us all the way from Tokyo.
Thank you.
It is 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Hey, congratulations to Senator Harry Reid. Based on all these factors, he says, the balance shifts against Judge Roberts. He's recommending... He's saying essentially he's not going to vote for Roberts' confirmation, and he's recommending the Democrats don't as well. Why? Because Slick Rob here, John Roberts, Slick John. That doesn't sound quite as good as Slick Willie, does it? We've got to come up with a better. Anyway, the Judge Roberts has just weaseled out of all of these answering all these questions, and it's a wrong thing. This in 1993. A reporter conducted an interview with Sir James Goldsmith in the United Kingdom. Sir James Goldsmith was worth about $3 billion at the time. He has since died. Billionaire speculator, one of the richest men in the United Kingdom. And he told this fellow in this interview, he said, in the great days of the USA, Henry Ford stated that he wanted to pay high wages to his employees so that they could become his customers and buy his cars. Today, we are proud of the fact that we pay low wages. We have forgotten that the economy is a tool to serve the needs of society and not the reverse. The ultimate purpose of the economy is to create prosperity with stability. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, a couple comments. First about Teddy Roosevelt, then about your guest.
Sure.
Teddy, I think what we could safely say is something I propose is that we actually... He was proposing a fair enterprise system.
That's right. He called it the square deal.
Yeah, and that's what we need to talk about now. It's not free enterprise, but fair enterprise.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. In fact, in 1907, he pushed through a law that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to political candidates.
Yeah, and if we look at every system the way our country is designed to begin with, the founding fathers realized there's something we needed called balance. Why don't we have balance in business, too?
Right, and the balance of the power of business. If business people can organize into a form called a corporation, why can't labor organize into a form called a union?
We always need a counterforce
yes.
on everything.
Yeah, it's just a simple reality. In fact, that's the way of nature. When one element in nature rises up and takes all over all the others, we either call that soon to be untimely death of a system or cancer.
And regarding your guest, two things there. One is everyone in this country, I think, should read the book Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yeah, and she has a new one that I just made our BuzzFlash Book of the Month, which is called Bait and Switched.
Yeah.
And Nickel and Dimed is where she went out and took blue-collar jobs. Bait and Switched is where she spent almost a year trying to get a white-collar job.
Yeah.
And it's in some ways even more horrifying than Nickel and Dimed.
Yeah, so anyone believes that the, quote, American dream, which of course to me is not even close to what the Founding Fathers intended the American dream to be, is not alive and well. And in her first book, she was also going for $7 an hour jobs, not minimum wage jobs.
Right.
And couldn't survive on that. But one thing is your guest's reaction when you mentioned that, you know, the CEO pay thing, and he goes, oh, come on.
Yeah, right.
I am so tired of that kind of thing that you see often on the talk shows and so forth. You'll see the smirking of Ken Melman and so forth. that while they're lying there, or whatever their reaction is, always this thing of this false smile or this reaction of just laughing.
Yeah. Well, that's because they have no reaction. They have no. There is no honest reaction to that. There is no way that they can rebut that because it's a simple reality. So they try to dismiss it. And unfortunately, most of us aren't, or fortunately, most of us are not buying it anymore. Jeff, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that with us.
Take care.
I appreciate it. You too. Bill in Seattle on the line. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Regarding this whole illegal immigrant thing, personally, I don't think the Republicans will ever do anything about it. And the reason I say that is because I have some employees. And as an employer, it's virtually impossible for someone without getting a Social Security number and paying the taxes.
Right.
Well, initially, I was kind of naive about what's going on because these guys all gave me Social Security numbers. Well, it turns out that the four guys that I've got working for me now are all illegal. Yet they've supplied me with a Social Security number.
Sure.
And last year, I sent the government about $100,000 in withholding taxes. Now, nobody from the government, and this has been going on for a couple of years now, nobody from the government has ever called me back and says, hey, wait, we got all this money you're sending us, and we don't know where it goes.
Right.
And my feeling is that, you know, this is money that the government is getting from people like myself, and it's totally unaccountable.
Sure. And it accounts, you know, it accounts, there's billions of dollars there. My recollection, I'm probably wrong on this, but my recollection is it's about $6 billion a year in tax collections from illegals in the United States. Maybe that's just the Social Security contribution. I just don't remember the number, but it's substantial. It's not inconsequential. And oddly, you've got cons out there saying, oh, look at these billions of dollars we're getting from illegal immigrants, and we never have to pay it back because they can't claim Social Security when the time comes. As if, number one, taking advantage of people is a good thing. And number two, as if, you know, it somehow isn't a good thing that people who are not illegal immigrants be receiving those benefits and be paying those taxes, but instead be on the unemployment lines. I mean, it just makes no sense. It's absolutely nutty. Bill, thanks for the call and for sharing
that. Thank you.
I got to move along here. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan.
Hey, Tom. I'm just interested. You keep saying that the response to Katrina was a negligent response.
Criminally negligent.
But you provide evidence that they weren't negligent in other instances. So how can you argue that they wasn't intentional?
I think that this was, first of all, I think that when the previous ones that had happened in the year before in Florida, Charlie and whatever it was, it started with an F, that those had to do with elections. And that, you know, it wasn't about competent or incompetent. It was about helping to buy an election using the hurricane as an excuse to pass money out to people. So it was corruption. And that's why I said this is criminal incompetence. And then, of course, now they're getting their act together. But I think, you know, in this case, the biggest problem was that Chertoff didn't know that he was in charge. And he didn't tell Brown what to do. And Brown was waiting for Chertoff. And neither one of them were being told what to do by the president because he had to go eat cake with John McCain and then go talk to elders about Social Security. So,
but they knew what to do in Florida, though. But they know
they always know what to do in Florida because in Florida, that's Jeb Bush's state, and they got to make sure that a lot of money goes down there to keep Jeb reelected. And that's, you know, and that has been documented now by the Orlando Sun-Sentinel as just mind-boggling corruption. Enormous amounts of money being given away inappropriately. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. See you then.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.